We're now beginning the 39th Psalm. The title to this 39th Psalm states that it is to the chief musician. And as we know, the chief musician was that person who was in charge of the music service of the congregation. He was to take this psalm and to use it to the very best of his ability to make it appropriate for the worship that the people render to God. And then he states, even to Jeduthun. And Jeduthun seems to have been the name of the chief musician at the time this was given. In 1 Chronicles 16, verses 41 and 42, we read where David appointed a person by this name to be one of the choristers, and in all probability then he, at this time, had become the chief musician. The word Jeduthun means properly praising or celebrating, but here it is evidently used as a proper name and designates the one who was placed over the music or who had charge of the music. The title also tells us that this is a psalm of David. That is, David was the one who wrote the psalm. In this psalm, we find that David was troubled. He was disturbed by some thoughts that he was having. Thoughts about a subject that he had not fully resolved in his own mind. A subject that's very important and very dear to man. And as he thought about this, he tried his very best not to sin. Not to do something that would be wrong, that would be improper, not to do something that God would be displeased with. So it begins in the first verse by saying, I said, I will take heed to my ways, that I sin not with my tongue. Now David had made a resolve to God, and he reminded himself of this resolve, and it's a resolve that we ought to also have ourselves. He said, I will take heed unto my ways. Now this is one of the most important things that we can do as we serve God and as we try to live a life that is a righteous life. We must take heed unto our ways. We must pay some kind of attention to what our ways are, to what our actions are, what our activities are. We must do the very best that we can to walk circumspectly, to walk wisely, to not act like a fool would act, but to observe the course that we are walking in so that we are walking the proper way. Take heed to my ways. It's always well for us to stop and to take some kind of account, to take some stock, to do a self-inventory as to just which way we're walking. What kind of a walk are we carrying out in this life? How are we acting? How are we behaving? Let's stop and evaluate ourselves. If we do not know for sure what the state of others are, let us not be fooled by what our own state is. Let us not be deceived into thinking that we're doing right if we're not doing what's right. So let's take heed to the ways, like David says he's going to do here. Let's pay a special attention to what we are doing, what our actions are, and see if we be in the right way. Let's try ourselves. Let's see if we be living according to this will of God. And the second thing he says is that I sin not with my tongue. Now here's one of the special things that he was going to take note of, and that is that he not say something with the tongue that would be improper, that he sin not with the tongue. Now the tongue, of course, is one of the most difficult areas of man's activities to control. It is a highly sophisticated method of communication, our use of language, and it can be used for much good, but it also can be used for much evil. It has power to be used both ways, and so much control must be placed upon the tongue, and much consideration must be given to see that we sin not with the tongue. Now, that's a very important area. James talks about the tongue and how difficult it is to control the tongue. In James, the third chapter, beginning with the second verse, for in many things we offend all, if any man offend not in word, the same as a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. Behold, we put bits into the horses' mouths, that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold also the ships, which though they be so great, and are driven of fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. Even so the tongue is a little member, and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and is set on fire of hell. For every kind of beast, and of birds, and of serpents, and of things in the sea is tamed, and hath been tamed of mankind, but the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made out of the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessings and cursings. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. So James is talking about the tongue and the difficulty in controlling the tongue and the importance of controlling the tongue. And so that's what David is mentioning here in this psalm. He's talking about the fact that he is resolved that he will sin not with my tongue. And that's a resolve we ought to all make. Let's do our best not to sin with the tongue. And David further describes it. He says, I will keep my mouth with a bridle while the wicked is before me. Now this word bridle here really means muzzle. He's going to put a muzzle over his mouth so as to not sin with the tongue. And especially while the wicked is before me. This is the most important time for us to be most careful of the use of our tongue. For if we have improper use of the tongue in the presence of the wicked, there are several bad consequences that can come from this. First of all, the wicked are lying in wait, trying to trap us some way. They're trying to find something wrong with us. They're trying to find something to blame us with. And when we misuse the tongue, they've just found it. Now, that's one of the surest ways to be justly blamed of doing something wrong is to misuse the tongue. But secondly, if we misuse the tongue in the presence of the wicked, we also can misguide or mislead them. Rather than to set a good example for them, we lead them away from God rather than to lead them toward God. There's no way you can misuse the tongue and lead the wicked to God. That you can misuse the tongue and cause the wicked to repent or to do the things that are appropriate in the service of God. This just doesn't work that way. We have to use the tongue in a proper manner in order to set the example before the wicked. So he says, I will keep my mouth with a bridle while the wicked is before me. Then he says in verse 2, I was dumb with silence. I held my peace. So that he was most careful not to misuse the tongue, so careful, as a matter of fact, that he was like a dumb person. He was silent. He held his peace. He didn't say anything. He says, even from good. He didn't even say good. Now we wonder why David acted this way, why he didn't even say good. And we have to believe that he probably was overdoing it. He was bending over backwards to control the tongue to the point that he didn't even say good. Now, we cannot agree that the Bible teaches us that we're not to say good. We are to say good. We're to proclaim that which is good. We're to praise God, and we're to proclaim the praises and the honor and glory of God, the works of God. We want to declare these things. But David here in the presence of these wicked persons was so overcautious that he held his peace even from good. And let's see what the results of this was. He says, and my sorrow was stirred. Now this didn't have a calming effect upon him to hold back even that which was good in the presence of the enemies. This just made his sorrow to be stirred or to be activated. He realized that even more now that there was something that was not right. This didn't resolve his difficulty or his problem. So it's not enough then for us to do nothing in order to try to keep from doing something that's bad. We must do something that is right. We must do what is proper. We must do something in a positive way. Just as surely as we hold back from the wicked acts in a negative way, we want to bring forth the good acts in a positive way. Because to do nothing does not resolve our difficulty. It doesn't calm down our sorrow. It doesn't make us any more satisfied, really. As a matter of fact, we are less satisfied when we do nothing. And that's what David had done. He'd held back even from good, and his sorrow was stirred. He further described this in the third verse, my heart was hot within me, and while I was musing, the fire burned. So his heart, that is his mind, was aflame. It was burning. It was ever more active. The less he said, the more he held back, even from the good, then the more his heart was activated. The more it burned, the more it smoldered, the more he had difficulty holding back. He says, while I was musing, the fire burned. This word for musing actually means to consider or to think about, to spend some time contemplating. The more he thought and the less he said, the more the fire burned. There were good things that needed to be said. There were thoughts that should rightfully be expressed. There was a problem that David was concerned with here, and he was not posing the problem. He was remaining silent about it, and so his heart was hot within him, and the fire burned while he was musing. So he says in the last of verse 3, then spake I with my tongue. He did finally decide, okay, I'm going to speak. I'm going to say something. It's not enough to remain silent and to say nothing. I'm going to say something. And what he says with his tongue then is a prayer to God. Now, he didn't want to say the wrong thing to the enemies, to the wicked, to those that were opposed to God. He's afraid he might run them further away from God. He might give them some occasion to blame him. So he turns to God and he makes a prayer to God. And in this prayer to God, he expresses his thoughts. He expresses concerns. He expresses the very thing that is troubling him so greatly. He says in verse 4, Lord, make me to know mine end and the measure of my days, what it is, that I may know how frail I am. Here we have given in this verse what David finally did say when he decided to speak. Some say that this was a breach of the promise that he'd made to remain silent. But rather than it be a violation of that promise, it probably is a making up for the fact that he had gone beyond and didn't even speak from when, those things that were good. He'd even remained silent from good. And we know that we're not to remain silent about the good things, only in regard to the bad things. We're not to speak things that would be sin, things that would be bad for us to say. But we are certainly free to say the things that are good to be said. So when he decided to make up for that and to begin to speak about the good, this is the very first thing that he said. This is the thought that he brings forth. He prays to God to make him sensible of the shortness and uncertainty of life and the near approach of death. This is one of the most important subjects that we could dwell upon, one of the most important subjects that we could speak about. And so he says, Lord, make me to know mine end. Now, this is not what it sounds like on the surface, that David is asking to know when he's going to die. God's never promised to tell any of us when we're going to die. He's never given any kind of a hint that he's going to give us that information. It's not for man to know when he's going to die. So rather than ask that, what he's asking here is that the Lord will acquaint him and to help him to meditate upon this fact that death is something that is approaching. And so rather than ask when he's going to die, he's simply asking here for the Lord to make him to consider, first of all, what death is. What is death? What is my end? Make me to know my end. The end that he speaks of here, of course, is death. And when we begin to think of death, we find that it's a good question to ask. What is this thing going to be that we call death? Just what does it mean? And we find that it is a final period to our state of probation and preparation. It's an awful entrance upon a state of recompense and retribution. To the wicked man, it's the end of all joys. To the godly man, it's the end of all griefs. So we simply sing, Lord, give me to know my end, to be better acquainted with death, to be more familiar with what death really means, to be more affected with the greatness of this change that's going to be brought about by death. Lord, give me to consider what a serious thing it is to die. So that's really the first thing he's asking here, is to help me to know what death really is going to mean. And then he says, and the measure of my days. So not only does he want to know more about what death is, but how near it is. Lord, give me to consider the measure of my days, that they are measured in the counsels of God. That is, the end is a fixed end. My days are determined, and that the measure is but short. My days will soon be numbered and finished. When we look upon death as a thing at a distance, we're tempted to put off the necessary preparations for it. We tend to be neglectful. But when we consider how short life is, we see ourselves concerned with what we need to be doing. We put our hand to the task of making preparation for it. We not only use with all the strength that we have to bring this about, but we also use haste. We want to do it as speedily as possible, because death is something that is not only sure, but it's going to come before very long. Our days are measured. We don't have an unlimited number of days. Nobody can say, well, I've just got time without end. I don't have to make any worry about death, because we're all measured, although we don't know when that time is going to come. Then the third thing he says, not only does he talk about the measure of my days, he says, what it is, that I may know how frail I am. And here again he's talking about the fact that death is continually with us. Lord, give me to consider how frail I am, how scanty the stock of life is, how faint the spirits are, which are the oil that are in us to keep the lamps burning, so to speak. We find by our daily experience that the earthly house of this tabernacle is moldering and going to decay. Lord, make us to consider this, that we may secure mansions in the house not made with hands. So, when we're thinking about death, these are very important thoughts. These are good things to be thinking about. These are appropriate things. These are things that will bring us closer to God, bring us closer to our duty, to our realization of the reality of the shortness and the brevity of this life, and in our frailness, how that death could come upon us any day. And we're not planning for death to be this day. No, but death could come this day. This could be our last day upon earth, because we are so frail. We encounter things on a daily and almost hourly basis that could bring about the end of our life. Any one of us could have a heart attack. Any one of us could have a terrible accident. Any one of us could meet with some kind of a violent end when we're least expecting it. So we're frail. We do not have immortality at this time, and we need to know this. We need to realize this. So we think about death. We want to know what death is, know what our end is, and the measure of our days, the fact that we're only temporary here, and then how frail we are, that it's a sure thing we'll never be able to get by without going through this death. Then he says in verse 5, behold, thou hast made my days as a handbreadth, and mine age is as nothing before thee. Verily, every man at his best state is altogether vanity. Selah. After stating that life must come to an end, and that he wants to know what his end, or what the significance of death is going to be about, he now states in the fifth verse that life is brief and that it is vain. Behold, thou hast made my days as a handbreadth. Life is certainly short. Man's life on earth is short and of no continuance. And that is the reason why we should prepare for the end of life. Behold, thou hast made my days as a handbreadth, the breadth of four fingers, a certain dimension, a small dimension. And the measure of this we have always about us. It's always before our eyes. We need no rod, no pole, no measuring line to take the dimension of our days. Nor do we need any skill in arithmetic to compute the number of them. No, we have the standard of them at our fingers' end, and there is no multiplication of it. It is but one handbreadth in all. Our time is short, and God has made it so, for the number of our months is with him. It is short, and he knows it to be so. It is as nothing before thee, so he says. He remembers how short our time is. It's as nothing compared with thee. All time is nothing to God's eternity, and much less our small share of the time we have here in this life. So as we think of the fact that we surely must die, death is an inevitable part of our existence here, and as we think of the fact that our life is so short, that it's so brief, we may live what seems to be a great number of days in the eyes of some, but nevertheless, even at our very longest, we have but a brief little stay here upon this earth, and in comparison to the eternity of things, we are really as nothing. And then he says, also in verse 5, verily every man at his best state is altogether vanity. This shows how that life is truly a vain state. That is, it is of so little value. It is something that we cannot take any stock in. We cannot count on it. We have to be preparing for a better life. We have to be preparing for replacing the life that we now have with one that's going to be of an eternal nature. We have to be laying up for ourselves treasures in heaven. We cannot put all of our stock, all of our hopes, all of our treasures into this life, for life is so vain. We don't have any promise of it. It is absolutely worthless when it comes right down to our being able to really depend upon it. It is vain. He says that verily every man is vain. There is no exception to this. There is no one who has a life that has more surety, a life that has more substance to it than another person has. For when it's all said and done, all of our lives are going to come to an end. We're only here for such a brief time, and there is no question about the fact that this time is going to come to an end. So every man, at his best state, is altogether vanity. So there's no exception to the rule that every one of us need to be preparing for the better life, for the life after this one, and getting our account settled with God so that we then, when we come to the end of our days, will be able to dwell with God in eternity. We're going to close our lesson at that point. Next time we'll begin with this fifth verse. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.